The Curve with Michelle Martin and Bernard Lim replay from Money FM 89.3.
It's time for Powering Your Property with Karamjit Singh, Senior Consultant at Real Estate Firm JLL and CEO of ShowSuite. ShowSuite.com is a new homes portal where you can experience your new dream home in 3D and VR. And you can download the app for free on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store. Well, developers will now have to bear new responsibilities to prevent money laundering and terrorism financing from happening in the real estate sector. Based on a new bill passed in Parliament last Wednesday. Under the amendments, developers would need to carry out due diligence checks on purchases, keep proper records relating to these checks, and report any suspicious transactions to the suspicious transaction reporting officers. Or they also need to train employees and establish processes to manage and mitigate money laundering and terrorism financing risks, and refrain from dealing with the accounts or money from anonymous sources or buyers with obviously fictitious names. Now, Karamjit, property developers may not be as well versed in anti-money laundering checks as the banking and finance sector. How ready do you think property developers are in implementing these measures? And does it differ very much from what they are already doing?
Bernard, well, they have been required to do all these checks for quite many years now. It's just that it's now part of legislation, and hence they could be punished if they fail to do so or they're tardy in keeping proper records. So for quite a number of years, developers have been required to look out for suspicious transactions. And not just developers, but even property agents handling transactions, whether in the resale markets or for developers, are likewise required to do due diligence on the customer.
Karamjit, what do you think will be the biggest challenges for property developers to keep to the new rules?
Well, it's just that they need to ensure that the database that they are mining and verifying from is the right database, the updated database, and they keep proper records that they've done those due diligence checks regularly. In fact, right until completion, they're required to do so. And hence, it needs to be part of a process. And at the same time, they need to have proper records and ensure that the team members are trained to do the right things.
Mm-hmm. And how much cost is this expected to add to developers?
Well, it's not so much of a cost factor because there are services, online services, that allows them to carry out such checks. It's just that, like, for example, I can speak on behalf of ShowSuite, as we provide software services that helps property developers transact digitally, and we provide that due diligence check as part of the entire process so that it's part of a seamless process.
And why do you think these anti-money laundering measures were deemed necessary at this present time? And has the property industry been an easy target from people who do want to launder their cash?
I suppose it is, because real estate are high-value commodities, and there are ways where, I suppose, there have been instances where undesirable characters have managed to, whether it's, you could say, wash their money through property transactions. But in any case, I think at the G2G level, Singapore it has apparently been required to step up and ensure that it conforms to international standards. At the same time, to look out for, to ensure that developers report if they do suspect something amiss.
Okay. Well, the High Court has granted a sale order to Good Luck Gardens, $610 collective sale today, following a lengthy dispute. But the Business Times reported that Justice Wu Bi Lee also criticised marketing agent Knight Frank, the Properties Collective Sale Committee, and the committee's lawyers, Raja and Tan, on how they handled the sale. Now, owners of the 210-unit freehold residential development in Toh Tak Park Road went to court after seven minority owners objected, saying that the information was withheld, which could have allowed them to sell the property for a higher price. Objectors to the sale had previously claimed the committee marketing agent Knight Frank told residents that there would be a development charge for the site, but it later turned out near the end of the tender that there would be no development charge. Well, in court today, Justice Wu said that the valuation of the property by Colliers International at $542 million was not flawed, while a belated $637 million valuation by Asian Assets Alliance that the deserters submitted was. But Justice Wu also said the committee should have extended the tender by at least 1 week to give more time to inform bidders and sought owners to decide whether to raise the reserve price, following the update that there would be no development charge on the property, which the collective sale committee received from the authorities before the tender closed. Well, of course, hindsight is 2020, Karamjit, but what do you think would have been done better in this case?
Yeah, so I think there's several moving parts here. But I think the biggest thing that stuck out for me was the fact that there were some legislations that was enacted several years ago that specifically requires the sales committee to put up proposals regarding the method of apportionment and the terms of the collective sale agreement up for a vote and at a EOGM. So this was one thing that apparently was not carried out. And so what the judge wants all collective sale committees to do is to ensure that the voting takes place the approval process takes place by express voting rather than by implication, as what was carried out here, by the fact that the owners would be required to support by signing the collective sale agreement. So that was the biggest thing. And then I suppose that the other one was a case where the committee could have extended the tender closing date just to ensure that there was sufficient time for developers to soak in the new information regarding the baseline information. So there's always a commercial call on the part of the committee and the marketing agents. But again, it goes back to a situation where in doubt, I suppose it's always best to go back and consult the owners from whom the field committee got the mandate from.
So why was it not immediately clear from the start whether a DC charge applied or not?
So DC is an information that's not generally available. A process is required to be, the sales committee is required to go through a process of making an application to the URA for the development baseline information for which money needs to be spent. And usually sales committee gets that done once 80% support the collective sale agreement. Mm-hmm. So it's not uncommon. It's just a question that whether the market, the developers, have had enough of time to digest the baseline information once it was out.
Okay. Well, why did it seem as if the committee and the marketing agent were in a hurry to launch the tender even before they received verification from the authorities?
Yeah, so I don't think so they were particularly in a hurry. Well, at least that's not the impression that I get, that they were in a hurry. But I think it's quite usual for sales committee to go through a process of applying for the baseline just the moment they've received 80% mandate, launch the tender concurrently and ensure that the baseline is received well before the tender closes. So I think that in itself was fine. I think the question was the gap between when the development baseline was received and when the tender was closed. That seems to be what the judge referred to as they could have extended that gap in between the two.
Karamjit, what do you think are the biggest lessons that marketing agents or other properties that are planning to go en bloc can take away from this case?
Well, you know, the biggest test of whether an en bloc should be approved or not is really whether the entire process was handled in good faith by the actors involved. So that would be the sales committee, marketing agents and the lawyers. So what was the clear takeaway here was that the judge didn't find bad faith on the part of the committee and the consultants as much as the minorities tried to allege by making reference to disparities in valuation reports and the fact that some of the sales committee members had relatives who had also owners in that development. So the judge didn't find that to be improper. But I think the biggest lesson was to ensure that the procedures are adhered to down to the last letter. And then again, whenever in doubt, go back to the owners and consult.
Okay. Well, Karamjit, freehold commercial property Golden Wall Centre has been sold en bloc for $276.2 million to Cityview Holdings, a wholly owned subsidiary of Worldwide Hotels, which owns and manages hotel chains such as Hotel 81. An application for hotel use has been approved by the Urban Redevelopment Authority, the URA. And less than 2 weeks ago, Waterloo Apartments has been sold through a collective sale for $131.1 million to a wholly owned subsidiary of Fragrance Group. Well, we understand that permission has been given by the authorities for a change in the property's zoning from the existing residential with first-story commercial to hotel use. What do you make of these two properties which have been taken up by hotel developers?
So I think that obviously the big commonality is that they are both approved for hotel use. They're both in Centon Town. And it's one of those cases where they've been successful purely because of the government's approval or the approval that was granted for the site to be redeveloped to a hotel. Had it been zoned or strictly restricted to commercial or residential, chances are they would not have found a buyer that they did. So it's again a reflection that we're finding the market of demand for residential redevelopments like drying up substantially, but the pockets of opportunities that are springing up that allows developers to redevelop them into alternative uses such as hotel and perhaps to a certain extent commercial might still be able to find buyers and have their en bloc go through successfully.
So these two properties are located at a very central part of Singapore. Are residential property developers facing increasing competition from hotel developers for these hot pockets, so to speak?
I wouldn't say that residential developers will be facing strong competition, purely because URA will probably support the redevelopment of such properties into hotel only where they are found to be suitable. And so residential developments tend to take place generally in the residential areas, which may not necessarily have approval for conversion to hotels.
So you don't think that this is the start of an emerging trend, Karamjit?
You could say it is a start of a new trend because hotel values seems to have been rewritten. That is obviously going to give rise to more of such centrally located old developments, perhaps attempting collective sales, where especially they can be rezoned or converted to hotels. So that in itself might be a start of a new small trend, but the fact that the residential market is taking, it's feeling it's the heat from the cooling measures, I think that's going to be here for several months ahead to say until things change again.
Thank you, as always, for joining us. We've been powering your property with Karamjit Singh, senior consultant at real estate firm JLL and CEO of ShowSuite.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.